On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the DoD is looking for the commercial sector to help them classify their documents using AI. Some more vulnerabilities in CPUs found that you should be aware of. And Brian McHenry, Curtis, and I talk to a great guest, Alex Moore, the CEO of Boomerang, about email and productivity. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 299, recorded July 13th, 2018. Boomerang, robotic email. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you're shopping. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through the world of enterprise, but I definitely don't want to go on this journey alone. I'm joined by our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, how is the right coast treating you today?
Well, generally treating me quite well. We've got the regular afternoon thunderstorms just starting to roll in. I can see a little bit of the cloudiness go, hear a little bit of the thunder. But hey, it's July and it's Florida. So here we are, happy to be inside, air conditioned, and part of Twiet.
Fantastic. Now, are you getting ready for blackout? Are you getting your devices hardened yet?
Yeah, I'm sharpening my pencils and getting my reporter's notebook because, especially for DEF CON, that's as high tech as I go. For Black Hat, being a little bit more adventurous, heavily going with stronger passwords, going with VPNs, and looking up all of the little pocket Faraday cages I can find.
See, those were all really good tips right there. Maybe we should think about doing a show later about how to harden our devices to go to DEF CON, but that would be a great topic. Maybe we'll look into that. Well, folks, it's episode 299. We're about to turn that corner on Twiet, and what better way to get ready for the next centennial of episodes but to add a new addition to our co-host all-star panel here. Joining our cast of misfits on Twiet is Mr. Brian McHenry from F5 Networks. Brian, it is super great to have you as part of the team. Welcome to the team.
Thanks, Lou. Really excited to get started on this new gig. And I never knew when I did a couple of guest spots on the show here that it would turn into something long term and ongoing. But totally happy and excited to take this on. And hopefully I can share a little insight with the folks that tune into you guys every week.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, where are you calling in from today?
This is my man cave at home in New Jersey. So this is where I'll be coming from most of the time. I'm going to play around with different locations in here as the weeks go on, but this is the inaugural position.
Sounds good. Now, before we start the show, I want everyone at home to know your nickname. What do people kind of refer to you as?
So I had to come up with a unique Twitter handle, and I'm not super creative. So I tried B McHenry and that was taken. So I did BA McHenry, and that has turned into BAM. So a lot of different places that I show up, whether it's like at Black Hat or if I'm speaking somewhere, people are like, "Hey BAM, what's up?" And that's just how people know me. So, the A, if anybody's wondering, is Alexander.
Fantastic. So now if I throw it over to you during the show, if I go now, BAM, would that be okay?
That would be perfectly fine. I have actually, my wife got me last year cufflinks that have the 60s Batman BAM on it. So maybe I'll wear those one show.
I was going to say, maybe we might have to work that out because I'm not sure if Emil Lagasse, I think his name is, might be upset with us, but we'll have to see. We'll have to try it out. Fantastic. Right. Well, welcome, and we're very lucky to have you. So thank you so much for being here. Well, folks, we have a pretty great episode. We're going to talk a little bit about the DoD and the search for assistance from the public to classify their documents. And of course, we have a pretty amazing guest about email productivity and making email more fun. And that's Boomerang. And we have the CEO of Boomerang on, Alex Moore. But of course, we can't start the show without jumping into this week's blips. Now, I don't know if you remember, because there have been a ton of exploits and hacks lately, but this past January, we had the Spectre exploit, which affected most of every processor and CPU built since the 1995. What was it? Well, it was a vulnerability that involved a malicious program gaining access to data that shouldn't have the right to see, and doing so by exploiting two important techniques used to speeding up computer chips called supportive or speculative execution and caching. Fast forward to today, researchers at MIT are at it again, finding ways to exploit the hardware characteristics of your CPU, dubbed Spectre 1.1 and 1.2, because we definitely need revisions to the biggest exploit we've ever seen in CPU history. These vulnerabilities are similar to its siblings. What is the main theme? Well, it's the CPU's speculative execution, where the CPU performs work before it's needed in order to speed up the execution. While Spectre 1.1 also uses speculative execution to deliver code that overflows CPU's store cache buffers in order to write and run malicious code that retrieves data from previously secured CPU memory sections. Now, Spectre 1.2 is a bug that can be exploited to write a CPU memory sector that are normally protected by read-only flags. How are these vulnerabilities exploited? Well, luckily, both of the vulnerabilities require the presence of a malicious code already running on your PC. There are no patches yet, but both Intel and ARM acknowledge that there's some CPUs out in the wild right now that have the vulnerability, but AMD is staying silent for now. Microsoft, Oracle, and Red Hat have also said they're investigating the vulnerabilities to determine if there are mitigations for them. The research team did get a nice paycheck of $100,000 because of the vulnerabilities, and that's because of Intel's bug bounty program. Now the clock is ticking to see how fast the vulnerabilities can be patched before a real-world exploit can be found in the wild.
Hey, want to see how a company should respond to a breach? Let's take a look at TimeHop. TimeHop is a company that specializes in digital nostalgia, and they have released more information on the July 4th breach that compromised millions of users' personally identifiable information. When TimeHop first announced the breach, it revealed that the names and email addresses belonging to some 21 million users were illegally accessed, along with phone numbers belonging to about 22%, that's 4.7 million of them. Now, TimeHop has released the total number of accounts that provided some combination of name, email address, date of birth, phone number, and gender designation to the attacker or attackers. TimeHop has been very transparent in how it released information on the attack. It's provided its timeline and details, the effects, and the steps being taken in its aftermath. Now, TimeHop started on the right foot because they found the breach within 2 hours of its beginning. They've continued to do a good job demonstrating the kind of timely transparency that proves regulations to be what they're supposed to be: minimal requirements rather than a model of how companies should behave.
Hackers reportedly stole 600 gallons of gas from a Detroit gas station. I take exception with the notion hackers here, because this was probably fairly trivial way to access information that you shouldn't be. A lot of talk about weaknesses in Internet of Things or IoT and industrial control systems, aka ICS. This latest hacking news highlights the problem here. The thieves in this case exploited vulnerabilities in the gas pump point of sale software, which other IoT or ICS embedded type systems find very difficult to patch for a variety of reasons, whether it's the small footprint of memory or storage that's available, or things that are so hard coded that they can't simply patch things without breaking other things. Now, gas stations, we know, have long been the target of scammers, in some cases installing credit card scanners inside poorly secured pumps. Retail and point of sale systems remain big targets because you can directly monetize these attacks to generate money. There's no middle ground. You don't have to gray market some data or do something else to get money after the attack. This goes straight into your pocket if you're the attacker. Now, these systems are also poorly secured, whether at the physical, network, or software layers, because of a variety of either convenience or poor oversight or what have you. Now, this particular exploit, it really patterns against the other problems we see in the world of IoT, which have enabled botnets and like Mirai and Purserai to quietly be built into this massive scale. And that problem is not actually a firmware problem per se, but it's actually default or blank passwords. Now, this is where I take exception. There's no real hacking involved, right? I hold a high esteem for true hacking, where it takes some ingenuity to really find your way around something. This is probably something that was very trivial to execute and get access to the web interface of these gas pump systems. Now, this isn't the first instance in the last few months. It's actually been noted a fairly large attempt was executed in New Jersey at a BP gas station, and then another one in Texas. So we know gas stations and point of sale are going to continue to be targets. But here, this really, for me, highlights how dangerous the world of IoT and ICS can be. And we could see scanning and DDoS attacks really start to build into a scale that we really haven't imagined before.
Fantastic. Well, you can know how to tell whether you're making sure if you're patching vulnerabilities and using good passwords. And you know what? This is a perfect example. A vulnerability that was disclosed by NetGear over a year ago makes possible for attackers to remotely execute commands and gain access to the root directory of a router by using FTP. All it takes is scanning a network for devices with the Internet Protocol port 21 open and response text including 214 admin login. The vulnerability allows for attackers to compromise routers and then gain access to the local network. The main mitigation for the flaw? Well, just good practices on router configuration. Just changing the admin password can almost reduce the attacks down to zero. Well, according to a security analyst firm, Recorded Future, someone in the U.S. Air Force has some egg on their face. Someone in the chain of command had changed the admin password on their router and allowed a hacker to walk right in and steal sensitive slides for their Reaper drone maintenance training course books, and other maintenance documents. During the course of the interaction with the analyst, the hacker actually claimed that he'd spent his downtime watching live video footage from U.S. Customs and Border Patrol drones, as well as other aircrafts and ground-based surveillance cameras as well. If nothing else, this definitely is a lesson in why having good hardware patching and password hygiene is your first and sometimes best line of defense.
Speaking of defense, let's think about something you should be defending from. That's DDoS attacks. According to a couple of recent reports, they're getting bigger, faster, and stronger. Now, DDoS attacks don't arrive on little cat feet. They announce their presence with all the subtlety of a shovel to the face. Two just released reports show that these loud DDoS attacks are getting louder, larger, and more numerous with the passage of time. VeriSign and Akamai each released their quarterly reports on computer security, and each pointed to a 170 gigabit per second, 65 million packet per second attack that took down a full /24 subnet of the internet. And oh, by the way, it originated with a 12-year-old boy who used YouTube to teach his methods and recruit teammates who used Steam and IRC to coordinate the attack. Memcached was the tool, but the most important news of the quarter is that we might just have to rethink that definition we've been using for ScriptKitty.
And we mentioned earlier hardening our devices for Black Hat. Well, the LTE standard was supposed to make cellular connections more secure, and we find out now that it's broken too. We usually presume, in general, that these connections aren't easily sniffed like free coffee shop Wi-Fi or, in the case of Black Hat, hotel Wi-Fi. But a flaw in the LTE standard, meaning it's built into the RFC, can't easily be fixed or patched, means that a sufficiently motivated and funded attacker can target a mobile phone user and listen in on their communications. The good news is that encryption like HTTPS or VPN connections are good protections against such eavesdropping in this scenario, or if you're on unsecured hotel Wi-Fi at Black Hat. An article by Dan Gooden at Ars Technica provides good detail on the attack, including videos of how it's executed. It requires about $4,000 worth of equipment and a 1 mile proximity to the target user. Now, the forthcoming 5G specification has countermeasures built in for an attack of this nature, but they're optional. So there's a big outcry at this point to make sure that we do make those more mandatory in this new in the new 5G standard. Now, while this LTE vulnerability might seem alarming, what's more important is the continued efforts by various groups to make encryption ubiquitous, whether it's via VPN, HTTPS, or secure messaging. making these types of encryption more pervasive and accessible has been aided significantly by folks at organizations like Let's Encrypt, WhatsApp, and Signal over Whisper Systems, SSL Labs, among others.
I think by now we should just assume that retailers will have breaches allowing hackers to know our name, our address, our contact information, as well as our credit card numbers. One by one, giant retailers are getting a lesson in security patching and practices, and Macy's and Bloomingdale's are no exception. This past week, a letter leaked to databreaches.net. Macy's wrote to impacted customers that an unauthorized third party had potentially gained access to their personal information and, in some cases, credit card details. The leaked information could include customers' first and last names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, and birthdays. As a response to the breach, Macy's will provide consumer protection services at no cost. The company joins a long list of retailers, including Sears, Kmart, Whole Foods, and Under Armour, that have been impacted by data breaches in the past year. Hopefully, this is starting to be a lesson for online retailers. If nothing else, maybe the facts that 19% of consumers say they would stop shopping at a breached retailer and 33% would take a long-term break from them. Maybe a hit to their deep pockets will help retailers understand it's time to start caring about their customers' data and security. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But of course, first, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Quicken Loans. Home buying is not easy. It's stressful. When buying a house, I had to deal with multiple bankers. I had to deal with multiple representatives, dealing with finding my data over and over. Also, I had to worry about interest rate hikes. It's nerve-wracking. It seems like it takes forever. And of course, with interest rates on the rise, there's a lot of unpredictability when it comes to buying these homes. It causes a lot of anxiety. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans figured out all of this, and they're trying something new. They're trying something called the power buying process. And here's how it works. Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. And what is that? Well, it essentially gives you the strength of a cash buyer. And in this current market, that's actually a huge advantage as a buyer because sometimes you have to put offers right in at open houses at a moment's notice. Once you're verified, you can qualify for all their all new exclusive rate shield approval. And first, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part of that. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if the rates go down, your rate also drops. Either way, you are a winner. That is the kind of thinking you would kind of expect from America's largest mortgage lender, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, if you're thinking about buying a house, go out right now to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. In less than 10 minutes, all your info can be entered and you're on your way to home buying freedom. Now, again, to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Rate shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data, in comparison to public data records, equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030. Again, that is rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support and This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time to jump into the bites, and this one is a doozy. Of course, we've all heard about lots of sensitive data leaking from the DoD, either through personal emails or just storing documents on their personal devices. But we all know humans are fickle, and sometimes they make mistakes, and relying on them to keep our data safe and secret is not always the best policy or defense. Well, the DoD is finally taking a step to make this better. They have issued a request for information, an RFI, from the industry for technology that will prevent the mislabeling and accidental or deliberate access and sharing of sensitive documents and data. Now, the DoD is part of the Office of Secretary of Defense, and they're basically saying investigating the use of commercial solutions for labeling and controlling access to sensitive information. Now, the defense IT officials are also seeking software that must be able to make real-time decisions about the classification level of the information and the individual ability to access, change, delete, receive, or forward the information based on the credentials of the sending and receiving individual facility and system. Sound familiar? Well, if you remember that office assistant back from 2003, that wonderful Clippy, well, it sounds like the DoD is looking for classification Clippy. Rather than an autonomous machine learning system, the DoD is looking for an expert system that will advise humans and prevent making mistakes and inadvertent disclosure sharing by offering suggestions. Of course, the DoD also wants the system to properly assign security attributes to non-human readable data formats, including binary files, images, video, and audio files, so that the system can properly determine whether a given user should allow access or not. Of course, there is a stipulation. They want the software to make sure it works with things like Microsoft Office products, including Office Exchange, SharePoint, and Link. And of course, the DISA supplies Exchange email and SharePoint and Link as enterprises to the DoD. All right, so my first question, it goes over to you, Curtis. Is it about time that the DoD and other organizations are taking control of their data here? I mean, this sounds like they should have been doing this a long time ago.
Well, you know, I think we can say that they have been doing it. The problem is that the government now classifies so very many pieces of information. I was doing some looking, and the last time we saw any numbers on this at all was back around 2016, and it talked about how many tens of millions of documents a year are classified. So we're getting to the point where the volume is such that it's very difficult for human beings to adequately deal with it. Now, there's a separate conversation to be had about whether we should be classifying this many pieces of information, whether every document that is being classified should be classified. But again, that's a different discussion. I think we've hit the point where the government, as with many companies, has to deal with a volume that makes some sort of automated tool, whether it's machine learning, artificial intelligence, whatever term you want to use to describe it, that tool is going to be vital if they're going to stay current. And believe me, there are all kinds of complications that come from an excessively long delay in classifying any given document.
Right. So, Brian, you kind of have a little bit of experience with this. It's not easy to tag and classify documents, correct?
Not at all. So, you know, having built, you know, enterprise systems in my prior life before F5 and worked with these systems now at F5, just to make document data searchable is really difficult. And really, people think, oh, just index all the text in it. And that's not really what you want. You want it tagged in a certain way so we can classify it and categorize it. But when users are entering that data about their own documents, when you're relying on data user entry, it's very unreliable and it doesn't scale, because only some of the users that are really fastidious or really understand the importance of it are going to, you know, do that every time they enter a new document. So really, AI is where we do need to turn. Now, my question is the DoD really going to do an RFI and not include Google, who's quite obviously solved this problem at scale?
Right. Curtis, I want to ask you a question. So I think, you know, a lot of times organizations, they tend to just kind of throw it in and say, okay, anything that you write is immediately secured under the highest security. Only you have access to it. And then you kind of have to opt in other people as you kind of add people to that. And then you can have systems that kind of verify if you're allowed to add those people or not. Is that something that organizations should be doing rather than saying, hey, let me just go after the fact and go find all the documents in my organization that need to be secured using AI? Shouldn't they be starting at the creation side of things?
Well, if security was free, that would be a great way of doing things. But security isn't free, and it has costs at a number of different levels. One of them, of course, is the simple hardware and software required to properly secure things at the highest level. And that typically, especially on the government level, includes things like advanced biometrics and other multi-factor authentication requirements. Imagine if we started out with that being the default for every document that's created. The other cost comes in the transactional cost, if you will, the friction that great levels of classification add to the system. And most of the systems we use in business and government just are too inefficient already. Throw in that much friction and you're going to bring things to a grinding halt. So I would make the argument that from an economic standpoint, the proper response is to take it from the other point of view, that the default is that something is open unless there's some sort of clear and compelling reason to tag it with a higher level of classification or sensitivity. I think doing that and forcing people to think about it is the right way, because that lets human beings be involved where they need to be making decisions and allows for automation in the things that follow that, doing all of the tagging, all the marking, all of the classifying that comes from the human decisions.
Right, right. It's interesting that you said that, that humans should be making decisions. I actually saw a survey recently that cybersecurity professionals, and the stats said that 30% of people claim to be very knowledgeable about machine learning and AI in relation to cybersecurity analytics and operations, but only 12% have deployed or plan to deploy machine learning and AI for analytics and operations. So to me, I want to throw it over to you, Brian. It sounds like organizations are not making the right decisions here. Is it just education and awareness?
I think it's availability of quality solutions that are easy to deploy. Now, when I say that, you might say 30% have knowledge in this area and only 12% want to have plans to deploy it, because, you know, how many systems really are there out there that have a really good comprehensive implementation of machine learning and AI? I mean, we see that in every cybersecurity conference. You go to Black Hat or DEF CON or RSA, probably more famously, and you'll see the machine learning AI buzzwords flash here, there, and everywhere. Everybody's got it in their product, but who's really deploying it in their product in a way that's meaningful, in a way that's usable for the typical enterprise? And I don't think there's a lot of examples of that going around. Probably the only one that's even creditable, and I'm not even sure if this is fair, is the use of Watson over at IBM.
Right. Yeah, I think that the interesting thing here is that I guess it does make sense, like Curtis was saying, to come from the other side. Is obviously they have all these documents, this information already out there. So kind of having AI, machine learning, kind of jump in, be applied as policy across the organization, and to try starting to do detection and logging and key logging is a good way to kind of rein everybody back in. But again, like you guys were saying, sometimes this doesn't need to be the only level of security that needs to be in there. They need to start adding additional layers in there to ensure that things are secure. But we'll have to see what goes on. We'll have to see what kind of things they decide to pick. We might never know, but we do know that there are solutions out there that can help them. So we'll see where we go from there. Well, let's jump into the next bite. So you guys all heard about the vulnerability from the Apple iOS devices. And recently there was a patch that actually fixed a couple issues here. And one of them is that they patched to make it harder for law enforcement to access locked iPhones. But also a less public fix is they fixed the code that caused crashes on certain iOS devices when users typed the word Taiwan or received messages containing a Taiwanese flag emoji. Now, this particular vulnerability was essentially a denial of service attack, or what they call a null pointer dewrench reference. Now, the odd part here was the defect was super easy to reproduce. All you had to do is go into iMessage, Facebook Messenger, or WhatsApp and type the word Taiwan. Now, before the patches, the security researcher Patrick Wardle wanted to find a fix for the issue, so he got to work. Now, iPhones notoriously has a closed nature when it comes to around bug challenges. Their software's closed, it's hard to find. Well, it helped to isolate the memory locations that store the default reference null pointer and a faulty instruction that calls it. And Wardle was actually able to restore the image to pull some of the code libraries, and he eventually found that the crashes were being caused by code that classified messages based on emojis that contained. Now, Wardle traced the likely purpose of the bug code to documented iOS behavior that hides the Taiwanese flag from emoji menu or from being displayed on the screen when in the region set to China. Now, this is very interesting. So Apple blindly made a fix to appease a government, in this case China, and they changed the behavior too quickly. It sounds like they didn't have a huge QA process around this. And so they didn't have to lose business in China. And so they kind of deployed this patch so that the that things would kind of go awry when you tried to type this emoji or even the word Taiwan. Curtis, I want to throw it over to you. Is this something that we're going to see more and more from electronic companies because they don't want to lose business in some big markets like China?
Oh, absolutely. As China comes to parity with and perhaps even surpasses the U.S. in terms of the number of consumers that are there, I think we will see many more people or many more companies that come up with fixes that are, let's say that they're kind to the Chinese government's sensitivities. I think the real question is whether they do this in versions of their product that are specific to the mainland China market, or whether they make these part of their general global distribution and just have them turned on when, as we've seen here, the region becomes that for China. And here's something else that I think is going to get even more interesting. We are probably no more than 5 to 10 years from China no longer being the most heavily populated nation on Earth. India is poised to pass China. So that means we're going to have two huge population centers. India, in terms of its technological sophistication, is in many ways where China was probably 40 years ago, but it wants to reach parity. So over the next few decades, we're going to see this sort of thing play out in a lot of different regions on a lot of different topics. And I think it's probably going to play to extents we haven't seen in a long time with just how global any electronic product can be.
Right, right, right. So this is just a very simple example. Like you were saying, hey, like they just didn't want to see that text show up in any of their applications. So they kind of put a block in it for them. You know, Brian, thrown over to you. You know, just as kind of off of what Curtis is saying, this is just the beginning. What we're going to probably see, it's not just text. It might be hardware requirements, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's actually not the beginning. It's more of the same. We're seeing it, in my experience over the last several years, government-approved cipher strings for TLS is a big example of that. So in Russia, the government requires GOST, their government-approved cipher suite. In China, there's SM2, which is now SM4. Now, these are the China national standard. And if you think the reason for that is because they want to eavesdrop, you're correct, right? That's absolutely what these governments want to be able to do is they want to be able to offer encryption, but they want to also be able to eavesdrop on their populace. So in order to do business in these countries, if you want to deploy some network equipment that supports encryption, you better support the government national standard ciphers. And so that's just one example of the type of compliance requirements that are going to be required of enterprise tech vendors in particular, just to be able to do business in these various countries. And these are huge amounts of dollars that we're talking about, especially in the enterprise. Like China is a huge country, but their enterprise tech business is really taking off over the last several years. And that's something where, every company from F5 on my side to Microsoft on your side, Lou, are facing as they want to do business here and really address these growing enterprises that are in these new regions. It's a huge revenue center, and there are going to be accommodations made in the products, and there may be different versions of code shipping in different regions for that very reason.
Right. And I can tell you, like, from experience, having different code bases, even talking about forking the code or having different portions of the code be different due to regional requirements is tough. It's tough to do, and it's tough to maintain because you have to have different testing processes for all of them. You have to verify in different environments and different hardware. So I really think that, Apple was almost reluctant to push back a little bit here. But, when there are requirements from government agencies to say, hey, we're not going to allow your devices to come in or even be sold here because of this, it kind of makes sense. Curtis, I want to kind of throw it over to you before we move on. This sounds like almost like Apple kind of rushed to do this to make sure, and they didn't really have a plan for it. So as Brian and you have been saying, hey, like organizations are planning for this. They're knowing that, hey, there's going to be specific new requirements like in the EU or China or in Asia, and we're going to have to kind of appease those types of governments by making hardware changes and software changes. It sounds like Apple wasn't ready. Is this something that they we've seen in the past with them? Because it sounds like enterprise is not really on their forefront here.
Well, I think it's obvious that enterprise really isn't at the forefront of Apple thinking. It's not where they make the bulk of their money, even though they are huge presences in the enterprise through their iDevices and even the Mac. But you're right. This has all the hallmarks of a project where someone said, oh, this will be an easy fix, but they didn't fully think through all the ramifications. And I think everyone who's been involved in tech has seen things like this, where the fix itself is, in fact, pretty simple, but there are just all kinds of ramifications that you need a rigorous testing regimen to work through, find, and take care of.
Right. Well, I'll have to see. I mean, I think, like you guys have been saying, organizations need to be ready for this, and they need to have, you know, their CI/CD loops ready to go, and they need to make sure that they have the QA processes in place for be able to handle these types of regions. So we'll see what happens. Fantastic. Well, folks, that does it for the Bytes. Of course, now it brings me to the my favorite part of the show, which we get to bring a guest in to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today is no exception. We actually have an in-studio guest, and that is Alex Moore, CEO of Boomerang. Alex, welcome to the show. We're really lucky to have you here. Thank you for coming.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, I can tell you right now, I'll be honest, I use Boomerang every day, so I'm a little bit biased to how great this tool is, but we'll try to be open and talk about its technologies and how it makes things easier and how it kind of helps users along. But first, I wanted to maybe kind of get a little bit of history just about maybe you and kind of how you started in the tech business.
Sure. So we've been Boomerang's going to turn 8 years old in August, which is amazing to me. So we've been doing this for a while. Before that, I was an analog circuit engineer helping make HDTVs 10 cents cheaper. And I was just living in my email. I was, in Outlook all the time, sending emails to folks, following up with folks, trying to get them to get me the stuff that I needed them to get me. It was just kind of I've always kind of been an email geek. Even when I was in MIT, I was really interested in like productivity, personal productivity in email. And so I think as I became subject to the problems, I kind of thought, hey, let's go do something about it.
Right. Now, Boomerang has had quite a ride as a startup, and I love some of the stories that I've heard in the past. You start out as TechStars, funded in 2009. Can you give us a little history? And also, I want to hear the story about getting some money when you were giving a ride to somebody.
Sure. Yeah. So we started back in Boston. We were freezing. We were cold. We weren't exactly working on Boomerang. We were working on a different email related thing. Kind of pivoted around, changed our business model, changed our product. And then found something that was working with Boomerang. So we tried to raise a seed round for Boomerang back in Boston. It didn't go super well. Winter was coming. We were running out of money, and we came out to Silicon Valley to see if it is in fact different out here. And it was. So one of the things that we were here in between a couple. I think I was out here between a couple weddings, and my wife and my co-founder Mo was on her phone in the hotel room, and she was like, "Go get in the car. Get on 101 right now." And I had no idea what she was talking about, but when she says go, I tend to go. So it turned out that Dave McClure, one of the folks behind 500 Startups, was looking for a ride to his auto mechanic, and whoever picked him up could pitch him on the ride over. So I was the first one to get there, picked him up, drove him over there, and dropped him off. And on the way, we talked about Boomerang, talked about the user growth, talked about the direction we wanted to go with the company. And at the end of the ride, he agreed to invest and bailed us out and kept us going.
And that's crazy. Now I read a little bit of it and I thought, hey, like he just gave you money just out of the seat of his pants. But it sounds like he was already kind of preparing that. He already had some information about you in the past, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, his assistant was a heavy Boomerang user already. He'd gotten intros to us from a couple of other folks. He had some exposure to us, and we'd been trying to set up a meeting for a couple months before that, but he travels all the time, so it's hard to pin him down.
Right. So, you know, the interesting part here is Boomerang is essentially using email as a platform. And now I'll tell you, for instance, I came from the Dynamics CRM team. And of course, I owned at that time the Outlook add-in for them, the Comm add-in at the time, and then now the Agave add-in. And now I moved off of that team and I work in Office on the Agave team, which is actually the Office add-ins team. And I'll tell you one thing is email's tough. I mean, it's tough as a platform because people, it's very personal to them and they feel like their productivity sometimes comes from that. So can you tell us a little bit about like why you decided to use email as a platform rather than maybe, let's say, building your own email client?
Yeah, I mean, building an email client means you have to do everything that Outlook or Gmail does as well as Outlook or Gmail plus stuff on top of it, which is really a lot to bite off, you know? So for us, what we really cared about was giving users tools they needed to be more productive. And we thought the fastest path and, you know, the most effective path to doing that was to just integrate with the tools that they're already in, the tools that they're using every day, the tools that they're acclimated to and are used to and already know how to use. And just, you know, add the features that they need right in line, right where they'd expect them to be. And, you know, it wasn't really possible to do that much before we got started. I mean, we started as a browser extension on Gmail. And then you mentioned Comm add-ins. I mean, we couldn't do the stuff we're doing today with the Comm add-ins platform. So it's kind of a convergence of this is a good path to get users the tools they need with the technologies available for us to do so.
Right. And even when you started on Gmail, they didn't have a plugin or an add-in model. So you said you had a browser plugin, but even then, that would be almost like you were screen scraping, right? To be able to get data from emails and to be able to perform the operation you needed to perform.
Not exactly, but sort of in that direction. It's kind of your JavaScript runs on top of Gmail's JavaScript. So it is a little bit of reverse engineering Gmail and figuring out, okay, where do we want to put our button and how do we find the button that's closest to that? And you know, so it was definitely a technical challenge, and that's gotten a little bit easier in the new Gmail. You know, they've got some hints in there for add-in developers to say, okay, cool. You know, here's the thing you're looking for. So it's gotten a little bit easier over time, but it was definitely a challenge when we were getting started.
Right. And I can say that we've seen, you know, applications and stuff built on that platform and be able to get data like that. Sometimes if they just make a quick change to their software somewhere, that could potentially break you. It sounds like you guys had to have maybe around the clock servicing for something like that to make sure that you guys keep running.
We got really good at updating quickly.
I bet. So let's talk a little bit about some of the features that you guys have. So there's some pretty good. Obviously, the main features, obviously, what comes from the name Boomerang is the ability to boomerang emails, to be able to kind of push them out so they're not cluttering your inbox and kind of have them come back later when you want them to come back, so they don't kind of get in your way. Can you kind of maybe go through some of the features and why you guys thought about, you know, bringing those into the platform?
Sure. So my favorite way to use the feature you're just describing, the boomerang feature, is actually to have messages only come back if you don't get a reply. So you can, when you're sending an email, say, "Hey, boomerang, remind me in a week if I haven't gotten a reply to this message." And so it really takes the mental load off of you. You don't have to keep track of, you know, here are the 45 things that I'm expecting from somebody else, but that I can't make any progress on until I hear from them. And just, you know, put that off into the software so you can focus on, you know, on what you need to do at that time and what you can do to be productive. And I think that theme kind of runs through everything else we do. The latest thing that we've added is a feature called Inbox Pause, which also helps you focus on what you need to do right now. So that actually stops incoming email until you're ready for it. So you can pause your email, work on something for, you know, 3 or 4 hours. And still get emails from your boss or from, you know, something you're urgently waiting on, but not get interrupted throughout the entire workday, you know, with a constant bombardment of like list messages and things like that. So I think that's really kind of the theme that runs through everything, is help people focus on what's important to them.
Right. And so we talked a little bit about before in the beginning of the show about AI, machine learning, and it sounds like you actually have some new features that are coming in, which is the Boomerang Respondable, where you're doing a little bit of AI to help people better write emails. And I actually saw this feature a while back. There's a product called Textio. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, where they actually help you with your job postings, and they kind of gamify it by giving you a score on whether your job postings, you know, leaning to a little bit to the rough side, if it's leaning to one gender or different areas like that, it kind of gives you a score based off of that. So that seems like that's what you guys are doing here, but you're taking that to a whole new level to make sure that you're writing these emails correctly. Can you tell a little bit about that feature and maybe how you guys are using natural language processing for it?
Sure. So that feature came out of we have a data scientist who was helping us figure out interesting things that we could learn about how to help people communicate more effectively. And so the Respondable feature came out of a blog post we wrote, I think back in 2015, where we just looked at a bunch of factors and said, hey, do these help people get more responses to their email? And so we wrote we wrote the blog post, we shared it with a bunch of our customers. And they said, this is fantastic, but, where I'd really want to see this is when I'm actually writing an email, not just, in this blog post and have to run all these calculations myself. So the technology behind this is really amazing to me. It's probably one of the largest distributed real-time machine learning projects out there. As you're typing an email, the algorithms are running against a corpus of, I think, 115 million emails now, trying to figure out, is this going to work well or not? And so it's all doing it in real time, and it's based on data for emails that people actually want to get replies to. So when you check that box at the bottom where it says boomerang this tomorrow afternoon, if somebody doesn't reply, that means you're giving us a signal that this email is actually intended to get a reply. So we're actually able to filter out the noise of a bunch of emails that aren't intended to get a reply, like the emails from Banana Republic or something like that.
Right. So this brings us to the next question. I think Brian McHenry actually has that question a little bit about how do you secure that data?
Yeah, so it's a big concern, right? We tend to amass massive amounts of personal data in our email, whether it's my Amazon purchase history or it's more sensitive information such as health information and what have you. Not to mention what I might be amassing as an employee of F5 and intellectual property data. So can you tell us a little bit, Alex, about how you've kind of put security and privacy in mind as you designed the Boomerang platform?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it's your email, it's really important that it stays private. So we don't access any emails that we wouldn't need to access in order to provide the service for you. So we're not downloading anything in the background. We store as little data as possible. We only store subjects and things like that for messages you schedule. And we do that so that if something goes wrong, we can send you an error email that actually tells you which email didn't send. And then, we don't sell any data to anybody. We never have. We don't let any humans read any emails. We never have. We think it's really important to be above reproach in terms of how we handle email and how we handle privacy. And, we're lucky enough to have a business model where our customers pay us, so we don't have to sell any data to anybody or collect any data that we don't absolutely need.
Do you use any sort of encryption for the data that you do need to store?
Absolutely. It's encrypted with FIPS 120 compliant encryption at rest. Everything in transit's encrypted. We're not a huge team, but we take it really seriously.
Yeah, I think it's actually easier to take seriously when you're not a huge team, and it's really comforting to hear that even as a smaller company, you're looking at really big mainstream standards that huge banks adhere to, like FIPS 140. So I think that answers my questions. Back to you, Lou.
Fantastic. Yeah. So I think that a couple of things I wanted to ask is a lot of these new features that are coming in, are these things that you're having a lot of customers ask you for? Like, I think obviously, being able to write email sometimes is an art. So this is a great feature for the Respondable, is a great feature for people to have. But a lot of the times, hey, being able to send later, some of these email clients have it. What kind of features are you bringing in that that you're kind of getting feedback from customers that they need?
That's a great question. I think at this point, probably 75 or 80% of our work is just addressing the things that the customers are asking for. On our Outlook platform, it's a little bit newer, that add-in. And so we've had a whole bunch of things like, oh, hey, can we customize this? Can we change this? And it's really sort of easy to know that when you have, 100 people emailing in saying, hey, I'd like to have this, it's easy to know that that's a feature worth building. And then probably maybe 20 to 25% of our stuff is a little bit more speculative. It's stuff that we don't necessarily know if anybody's going to want or not. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And sometimes, but some of our really cool stuff like Respondable is a hybrid of the two, right? It was a blog post we didn't know that anybody really wanted, but then some customers emailed in to say, hey, can you make it real time? So I guess it's kind of a mix for us.
Right. So some of the interesting things, so obviously Google, Gmail, but you also have your own, was it email client on Android as well? Like what kind of led you to doing that?
Yeah, Android and iOS. It's sort of necessity. There's not really an add-ins platform on mobile that can provide the features that Boomerang wants to provide. So the only way we could really make it available to folks on mobile devices was to build our own app. And that's been a lot of fun, too, because it's different for us to have complete creative control, you know. In Gmail, we want our add-in to look like Gmail and to feel like part of Gmail and to feel like it belongs. So much so that sometimes, you know, Google gets emails about Boomerang features asking them for changes. And the same for Outlook, right? We want it to look like it belongs in the ribbon, look like it should be there. And on mobile, there's not really an expectation of anything looking like anything. We can do whatever we want to do. So it's been fun to have that kind of creative control. And I think we've been able to do some really cool stuff. You know, our iPhone app has a voice assistant where you can say, hey, reschedule all my meetings for today. And it can do that for you. It'll draft emails, suggest times to everybody. You know, you look at them, you send them, and then it declines all the meetings. And it's not possible to do anything like that in an added environment. So it's really neat.
Right. Now, you guys, I remember you were doing a talk a while back and I was in there listening. And I noticed one of the quotes you said is, hey, like sometimes building your own email client's hard because you have to have I can't remember the number that you gave. It was like N number of features that if you don't have, customers will just kind of ignore you and move on and move to the next thing. Is this something that you also had? Obviously, you knew what those N things were, so you potentially put those into the iOS, Android clients. But are there new things that you have to continually to add to that feature set? Because, of course, email is continually evolving and people kind of expect more from it.
Yeah, it's definitely a constantly moving target. I mean, the email apps on iPhone and Android have gotten much, much better over the past few years than you know, back in 2012 or 2011. But you know, we've also been able to grow. We didn't start as a client company in part because we had just the three founders. These days I think we've got 21 engineers, and it's a lot easier to keep up when you've got a large enough engineering team, you know.
Right. Well, I'm going to throw it over to Curtis because he has some questions about kind of comparisons to some of those collaboration engines that are out there. Curtis?
Well, I think that one of the questions that I have is based on some huge trends we've seen, is something like Boomerang enough to keep email relevant? Especially when I talk to some of my younger colleagues, I hear people who very proudly say, you know, I just don't use email anymore. They use either instant messengers or they use some sort of collaboration platform like Slack or Microsoft Teams, WebEx Teams, something like that. So, you know, is your goal to really keep email as a viable collaborative and communications form for the enterprise?
I don't think we are, as a company, our mission's not tied to email. It's tied to personal productivity. And I think email still got a really important role to play in that and will continue to have an important role to play in that for decades. I think, you know, Facebook was supposed to kill email. Slack's been supposed to kill email. And the volume of non-spam email that's sent keeps increasing every single year. And that's not, you know, in the business world especially, that trend isn't slowing down. It's accelerating. So I don't think email is going to go away. It may become a smaller piece of the pie, the overall, you know, productivity and collaboration pie. But I don't think it's going to stop being a part of it altogether, if that makes sense. And I think one of the things that helps keep it alive is that the problems that happen right now, those collaboration platforms are mostly good for intra-team communications. And when you open them up to everybody else, right, if you all of a sudden start getting Slack messages from you know, Banana Republic, then all of a sudden the spam problems that email solved years and years ago all of a sudden become a Slack problem. So I think email is going to continue to stay really important for inter-team communication.
Well, when you talk about the personal productivity being the focus of your company, I get that. And, you know, my co-hosts have talked about things like the platforms you've been on and all of that. Now, I noticed looking at your site that you deal with things like scheduling. You really tie a lot of things together. when you look forward, can you imagine the fence around what you include in the boomerang platform getting bigger and bringing even more of these tools together under one sort of boomerang umbrella?
Funny you'd mention that. Yes, absolutely. That's one of the things that we're looking at is, you know, how do the different pieces of the pie fit together, and how do we add value on top of all of them? Because we're not currently platform agnostic, obviously. We're pretty email centric, but we definitely are looking at how do we bring the same kind of productivity tools to different platforms also.
Cool. So I wanted to throw it over to Brian because he wants to talk. He has a couple questions about the collaboration engine as well.
Yeah. So on that point of kind of branching out, I actually think rather than branching out, I'm more interested in a lot of times I have a conversation in Slack or Teams, and then it's related to an email thread I have going, and you know, not being able to view that in the same place or create some sort of logical link between the two is a challenge for me. And I'm wondering if maybe the guys at Boomerang might be working on solving that for me.
I can't really comment too much on that, but we're aware of that problem for sure. And you know, internally we use Slack, and we've built some prototype tools to kind of explore what does it look like. You know, email me this thread, and it kind of uses some AI to to basically take the chat log and split it into threads and email you the right thread. So we're looking at some possibilities there, and we're really excited about, you know, I think one of the things that's a challenge, especially with chat logs, is that chat disentanglement's the word I was looking for. One of the challenges is that everything kind of comes in as a continuous stream. And you basically need some AI technology to figure out what the different topics are and to try to group them together in a smart way. And, you know, obviously we're thinking about it because, you know, it's on our minds.
Right. So we have a pretty good chat room. I'm not sure if you can see it there, but we have a couple of questions. Kalu actually adds, can you cancel emails? Now, I'll tell you one thing. I've had this problem in the past. And in fact, I have a special Outlook rule that says do not send emails until 60 seconds after I actually hit the button send. And this is because sometimes I might send an email and I think, you know what, I don't think I worded that right, or I have to go back and send, maybe I sent it to the wrong person, or maybe I added extra people I shouldn't have. Can you actually cancel emails after they've been sent with Boomerang? Like, obviously you can schedule them to be sent later. Can they be canceled thereafter, or can they be set to be canceled, that kind of thing?
Yeah, totally. You can reschedule it, cancel it, edit it after the fact. I mean, when you're sending something to go out, you know, 2 days later, a lot could happen in those 2 days. So we definitely provide a way for folks to change what they're going to send or cancel it altogether before it goes out.
Right. So I think a couple other features that I find interesting is there was some talk about how you can make sure that, obviously, the feature about readability where you can make sure that it's worded correctly and so on. Now, do you see people actually, now is that on by default? Do people have to opt into that? And do you see people kind of reluctant to use that because they know that potentially their data is being sent somewhere else to get analyzed?
One of the things that is really cool about the way we implemented it is by default, it's actually local only on your computer. So we kind of built sort of like a modified version of like CoreML or something to embed inside of a browser. So we actually send the model along with Boomerang's code, and it actually runs locally without sending your data anywhere. If you opt into some of the advanced features, like if you want to know how positive or negative you sound, then it does go to our servers, but you have to opt in, and we throw all of that data away as soon as we're done processing it. We don't store anything.
Got it. That's cool. Now, there used to be a feature called email gaming. Is that still around? I can't remember if I saw it or not.
It lives. It doesn't get a lot of attention from us, but it lives.
Fantastic. Cool. Well, I guess, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I wanted to leave it up, see if there's any other questions from the chat room. Or Brian and Curtis, you have any questions for Alex?
I think I have had just about all of my questions answered. This has been a great guest, and I've been thrilled to be part of the conversation.
Fantastic. Cool. Well, yeah, Alex, we thank you for being here. We appreciate it. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Of course, folks, You've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise tech show, according to 9 out of 10 Boomerang emails. But of course, I want to thank our panelists from dropping some knowledge on Twilight, starting with my co-host in crime, Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, it's always a pleasure of having you here. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work and your adventures?
Well, it is a great pleasure for me to be here. And you can find my writing over at Dark Reading. I had a piece this week on how to protect DNS. Got another one coming up for next week on protecting the things that aren't DNS. Going to talk a little bit about things like BGP and network time protocol. Get all that NTP love going. So lots of good stuff happening over there. To find out when it's going to happen, please follow me on Twitter, KG4GWA. And I'm also starting to prepare for Black Hat. So if you're going, or if you're not going but have things you'd like to hear about, hit me up with a direct message on Twitter. We'll be happy to either meet you there or make sure that we get your questions answered.
Fantastic. Of course, we have to thank our newest co-host in crime here, Mr. Brian McHenry from F5 Networks. Brian, we are so excited for you to be here. Thank you so much for being here. Great show. You give you 30 seconds. Tell the folks at home where they can find you, all your work, and anything about F5.
Absolutely. Check me out on Twitter. That's the first place to find where else I'm going to be. So that's B.A. McHenry. That's where BAM comes from. Also, be sure to head over to Dev Central. That's F5's community site, devcentral.f5.com. That's where me and the rest of the customer solutions engineering team that I work with and try to lead to better and brighter places. That's where we put out a lot of videos, a lot of things designed to make F5 technical solutions easier to implement. And last but not least, head over to informationsecuritybuzz.com. I have a quasi-monthly column over there. My next piece will be out in a couple weeks, and it'll be about threat modeling.
Fantastic. Of course, I want to thank our guest today, Alex, CEO of Boomerang. Great show. Thank you so much for being here. We wanted to give you 30 seconds just to tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find your work, of course, where they can find Boomerang.
Thanks. We're at boomerangapp.com. I'm at AWMore on Twitter. Thanks so much for having me. Try Boomerang. I think you'll find yourselves being more productive with it. And it's made with love.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being here. And also, I want to thank you. You tune in each and every week. You are our loyal listeners. We couldn't do this show without you. And we want to make it easier for you to tune in and listen each and every week. Go right now to twit.tv/Twyatt. Find all of our back episodes, all of our show notes, all the information about the guests. Of course, links to our to the stories that we did to the show. Of course, then right next to that is that fancy and great subscriber button. Click that button and you'll be able to subscribe to the format of your choice, both audio, video, HD video, and of course on the device of your choice, whether it's phone, tablet, laptop, or desktop. And after you subscribe, share the show with your friends and family and coworkers as well. We love doing this show, and with your support, we can keep doing it. Now, after you subscribe, also remember we do the show live each and every week at twit.tv, live.twit.tv. That's 1:30 Pacific time. And you can come see how the pizza is made. Of course, you can come see us how goofy we are and off while we're not recording. And of course, if you're going to come see the show live, you might as well jump into the live chat room. And you kind of probably heard during the show, we pulled some questions from the live chat room. We have great people in there, and we love to kind of pull questions from there. It usually helps us with the conversation. So don't forget to jump in there and say hi. Also, don't forget to actually follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/LouMM. Plus, you can find all of my work that I do at Office and Microsoft Office. And check out that work at dev.office.com, where you can see all my posts and, of course, some of the greatest and latest customizations that Office experiences can have. Also, I wanted to thank everyone who makes the show possible. Thank you to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week and doing This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we thank you for their support. And also, I want to thank the engineers at Twyatt, as well as Mr. Brian Chi, our tireless producer. Hit him up on the Twittersphere for any ideas and show ideas that you might have about guests in the future. And before we sign out, we have to also thank our TD, Josh, for today, who's actually filling in for Kevin. Thank you, Josh, for being here. Do you have the camera on yourself there?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, that's okay. I wanted to continue the tradition here and just ask you, can you just tell us a little bit about what the main topic of the show was today?
Email?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was all about productivity. But well, until next time, maybe we'll try to get you. Yeah.
I was so close.
Well, until next time, I am Louis Maresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep twiet.